Go ahead and open your Bible back to 1 Kings chapter 22. Verse number 13 is where we're going to pick up the story. For your own knowledge, we have a parallel in 2 Chronicles chapter 18. And that passage for our story today is going to start at verse number 12. Now, this is the situation. We're talking about the year 863 BC, I believe. It's the spring or summer. There is a sabbatical year going on, the 79th sabbatical year. And Jehoshaphat, the king of southern Judah, has come northward to Samaria to spend some time with King Ahab of northern Israel. They are related by a marriage. The prince of Judah is married to the princess of northern Israel. And during their get-together, Ahab suggests that they should work together to take back all the area north of Ramoth-Gilead that is currently in the hands of the Syrians. Jehoshaphat's on board with this, probably because he sees the marriage between their two kingdoms as the first step toward repairing the breach that had happened almost 80 years ago now. But he wants to hear from He Who Is. He wants to hear from Yahweh supernaturally as to whether or not this is a proper military incursion to Ramoth-Gilead. But Ahab brings out his pet prophets, actually probably Jezebel's 400 pet prophets of Baal, and they start saying, "Oh yeah, you're gonna succeed." I told you last time that more than likely Ahab and the others have convinced themselves that Yahweh and Baal are all the same. They're just different names for the same God. We've got one of these prophets of Baal, who also pretends to be a prophet of Yahweh. He's running around with some bronze horns, like stylized like the horns of a bull, and he's pushing at the fringes of the prophesying area in front of the two thrones of the kings. And he says, "This is how you're going to push away." God says, "This is how you're going to push away the Syrians out of Ramoth-Gilead." But Jehoshaphat's not on board with this yet. He's like, "No, I want to hear from an authentic prophet of Yahweh, He Who Is." And Ahab says, "Well, I got one." But he never says anything nice about me. And Jehoshaphat says, "Yeah, don't be like that. Let's hear from him." So here we go. 1 Kings 22, verse 13. The messenger who went to summon Micaiah, that's the prophet of Baal, who's currently in custody of King Ahab, because he doesn't like him. He doesn't like the way he talks. So the messenger that goes to bring this guy effectively out of the dungeon said, "Behold, the words of the prophets with one accord are favorable to the king. Let your word be like the word of one of them and speak favorably." So he gives him a heads up. Hey, all the other prophets are saying that this is going to be a good military operation. You need to get on board with that. Verse 14, "But Micaiah said, as He Who Is lives, what He Who Is says to me, that's what I will speak." Good for you, dude. That's exactly what we want from prophets. It doesn't matter what the culture around them says. It doesn't matter what all the others around them say. They've got to say what God said. And preachers have got to be that way too. Doesn't matter what all the famous preachers or all the big wigs are out there saying. Godly preachers have got to preach the word. They've got to lay it out there the way God intended. Verse 15. When he came to the king, now the king that keeps getting mentioned here is Ahab. For whatever reason, throughout this section of 1 Kings, Ahab is not listed by his name, and then his son later will not be listed by name for whatever reason. So when Micaiah had come into the presence of Ahab the king said to him, Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth Gilead to battle, or shall we refrain? And then we have to imagine the tenor of his voice, the cadence of his voice. My guess is that Micaiah says what he says next with great dripping sarcasm. He answered, oh yeah, go up and triumph. Yahweh will give it into the hands of the king. So he basically parrots everything that the other guys were saying, but I think he says it in such a way that Ahab knows he doesn't believe that that's not really the message. Because verse 16, the king said to him, how many times shall I make you swear that you shall speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of he who is? So, I told you before, tell me only what God told you to tell me. And so, that's what he does. Verse 17, he said, all right, here's what I really saw. I saw all Israel, that's northern Israel, scattered on the mountains as sheep that have no shepherd. And he who is said, these have no master. Let each return to his home in peace. Now, that's pretty unambiguous, that if Israel goes on this military campaign against Ramoth-Gilead, they are going to get clobbered. And they will lose their shepherd, which is just a symbolic word for the king. And everybody's going to need to just head back home again after this defeat that's coming. And that's certainly how Ahab understands it. Verse 18, the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, didn't I tell you that he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil? So didn't I tell you that's what he'd tell us? I have to admit, I often wonder what in the world is going through Jehoshaphat's mind during all of this. He is a true believer in the one God. He insisted that a prophet from that one God come and talk to them and tell them what's going to happen. And so the one true prophet comes here and basically prophesies disaster. And yet, Jehoshaphat is going to go ahead and go on this ill-fated military incursion. Why? Why didn't he turn on his heel and head back south to Jerusalem? And I don't have an answer. The only thing that comes to my mind is perhaps he thought he could help Ahab come back out of this stuff, that somehow he could help him make the choice to avert this disaster. I've got nothing other than that. But anyway, back to the text. Micaiah is not done yet. Micaiah said, therefore hear the word of he who is. So, since I've got your ear, King Ahab, let me tell you the whole story. Now, the ancient name for prophet was Seir, as in someone who sees things. So these guys had visions, and then they would describe those visions. So here is his vision that he experienced, what he's basing his prophecy off of. I saw he who is sitting on his throne. So this is on my list of throne visions of God. It's right up there with Isaiah's vision of the throne of God, Ezekiel's vision of the throne of God, Moses' vision of the throne of God, and of course, John the Apostle's throne vision of God in the book of Revelation. So Micaiah is one of those rare individuals that actually gets to see the court of God as it's carrying out operation. So I saw he who is sitting on his throne, all the host of heaven, meaning the angelic realm, was standing beside him on his right hand and on his left. Now, the angelic realm is made up of both loyal angels and those that have rebelled but are still allowed to roam free and interact with humanity. They're on some sort of probation. And we have a couple of places in Scripture, Job being one of them, that indicates that from time to time, the fallen angels are brought into the courtroom of God the Father, and they have to make a report of whether or not they're keeping their parole. Now, what does their parole consist of? That they don't violate free will, human free will. I think that's the main point. If they violate the free will of humanity, then they will be pulled out and put into Tartarus. That's what the Greeks called this place of confinement, the chains of darkness that the book of Jude in 2 Peter chapter 2 talk about, where such fallen angels as those in Genesis chapter 6 ended up and are awaiting their final disposition. So I believe this is one of those places where there are at least some of these fallen parolee angels in the courtyard or in the courtroom of heaven. And so that's the right hand and left hand. Interestingly enough, Matthew chapter 25, when Jesus appears on his judgment throne, he's got all of the people divided like sheep and goats, right? And the sheep are on the right hand and the goats are on the left hand. And he says to the sheep on the right, well done. He says to the goats on the left, get out of here. And so it may be that the court of heaven is also divided up in that case with all of the loyal angels off on the right, all of the parolee angels, the fallen angels off on the left. Just something to chew on, something to think about. Anyway, verse 20. He who is said, who will entice Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth Gilead? So God throws it out there and says, all right, who will make sure that Ahab meets his death at Ramoth Gilead? One said one thing, another said another. Then a spirit came forward and stood before he who is, and I believe this is a fallen angel, saying, I will entice him. And he was said, by what means? And he said, I'll go out and I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. See, a fallen angel would have no problem with that. So basically, if you give me permission to stir the pot, I'll do it. You let me go down there, I'll make sure that his prophets get all this false information to make sure he shows up there for his death appointment. Verse number 22 continues. And he said, all right, you shall entice him. You shall succeed. Go out and do so. So God gives this angel permission to do that. And again, I believe it's a fallen angel. Verse 23. Micaiah saw this happen. I don't think he's making some sort of parable. I don't think he's making some sort of story up here. to back up his prophecy. I think he is describing exactly what he saw. And so verse 23, "Now therefore, behold, he who is has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these your prophets, he who is has declared disaster for you." So these 400 pet prophets of yours, the reason they're given these prophecies about go up to Ramoth-Gilead is because God wants you there and is allowing you to be lied to by your spiritual advisors. And this does not go over well for one of those pet prophets of Baal. Verse 24, "Then Zedekiah, the son of Kenaanah, came near and struck Micaiah on the cheek," basically slapped him across the face. "And he said, 'How did the spirit of he who is go from me to speak to you?'" So how dare you say that you know more about this situation than me? Verse 25, "Micaiah said, 'Behold, you shall see on that day when you go into an inner chamber to hide yourself.'" So you'll find out how things shake out and you're hiding in your little room. And the reason he'd be hiding in his little room is that he and the other 399 prophets are saying God is telling Ahab to go up against Ramoth-Gilead, it'll go swimmingly, it'll go wonderful, he'll win. But he's going to end up dead, and I can guarantee you his son is not going to be a happy camper about that. And he is going to hold these guys accountable for lying to his dad and getting him killed. And so their false prophecy will be punished. And so that's, I think, what Micaiah is basically prophesying here, is when you're cowering in your little room because they're getting ready to take you away to execute you, yeah, you'll find out. Verse 26, "Then the king of Israel," again, that's Ahab, "said, 'Seize Micaiah, take him back to Ammon, the governor of the city, and to Joash, the king's son.'" So Ammon's in charge of the city of Samaria. Joash has got some sort of important job in the city as well as the king's heir. And the instruction is, "You tell them, 'Thus says the king, put this fellow in prison,'" or perhaps even back into prison, back into the place that he's been confined, "and feed him meager rations of bread and water until I come in peace." So basically, you pin him back up and you keep him there on bread and water. I mean, minimal rations until I get back in peace. And I always picture this where Micaiah is being escorted out and he's yelling back at the king saying, "If you return in peace, he who is has not spoken to me." So basically, yeah, if you actually get back here, then I'm the false prophet. But then he yells out and he said, "Hear, all you peoples, you know, pay attention to what I'm telling you." And then he's gone, and we don't hear from him again. Again, I say, why did Jehoshaphat stick around? Why didn't he leave after having that display of God's testimony through a prophet that this is not going to go well? And there is no logical explanation for me other than apparently Jehoshaphat thought that he might be able to be of use in the aftermath of a defeat at Ramoth-Gilead. Let's see how that goes. Chapter 22, 1 Kings, verse 29. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up to Ramoth-Gilead. So they leave Samaria, they go down across the Jordan Valley, and then up into the hills of Gilead, and they get into a siege camp or an attack camp near this fortified city. Verse 30. Before I say this, let me tell you the normal procedure. In the ancient world, particularly this context, this historical area and time period, kings did not actively fight, except on very rare occasions. They would supervise the battles from some high place nearby, usually in their little chariot, so that they could move rapidly if need be. So everybody understood this, and it was almost as if it was commonly understood that kings are off limits for attack. You leave them alone. Rules of engagement didn't allow for kings to be attacked. So that was the situation of this time period. So verse 30 says that the king of Israel, Ahab, remember, said to Jehoshaphat, "I will disguise myself and go into battle, but you wear your robes." So I'm going to go and put on the uniform or the armor of a fighter. I'm going to go down and actually get into the hand-to-hand stuff. But you go ahead and you keep your royal robes on. You stay here in the supervisory situation in your chariot. So the king of Israel disguised himself and he went into battle. Now, the king of Syria had commanded the 32 captains of his chariots, "Fight with neither small nor great, but only with the king of Israel." So Ben-Hadad had told all of his command staff, "Pass the message down. When the battle gets started, I want everyone to go for the king. I want everyone to go after Ahab. I want him dead, dead, dead. First thing. Ignore everybody else. Just push forward until you can get to him and kill him." So that goes against the normal way of doing things, understand. And that comes as quite the shock. Verse 32, when the captains of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat, you know, they saw him up there on the hill, up at a high spot, and he's wearing the robes, they said, "Oh, that's surely the king of Israel." So they're seeing him from a distance, and they assume that's Ahab. So they turned to fight against him. They made a beeline for him. And Jehoshaphat cried out. So he's like surprised, and he probably has his chariot pull away and try to get escaped, and he's yelling and saying, maybe saying things like, "This isn't the way to do. We don't do this. This is against the rules of engagement. Stop." And that's when they realized he's not Ahab. Many of these commanders, many of these captains within the Syrian army are quite familiar with Ahab. So they realize this is not the guy. When the captains of the chariots saw that it was not the king of Israel, they turned back from pursuing him. Because remember, their instructions were, go after Ahab, nobody else. Focus on him. Verse 34. Now comes the miraculous part. But a certain man drew his bow at random. So there was an archer in the Syrian forces. He just pulls back his bow. He's not aiming for any one particular person, but he lets go of that arrow, and it struck the king of Israel between the scale armor and the breastplate. We don't know exactly how that comes into the details. My guess is that we're talking about the little place in the armpit area because of the way that armor goes on and needs to be movable, that's not covered. And so it says randomly here, but I say by the act of God, a random arrow shot just happens to penetrate right there in that area. Probably a lung shot, which of course is a mortal wound in this period. And so when he then said to the driver of his chariot, "Turn around, carry me out of the battle, for I'm wounded." So Ahab realizes he's in trouble. And if it is a lung shot, he would have been having a hard time to breathe. And he would have also, as a long time king who was at battles and knew wounds, he would have known this is a bad one. So he asked to be taken out of the battle. Verse 35, the battle continued that day. The king was propped up in his chariot facing the Syrians. So he wanted to watch what was going on down below him. But he eventually loses too much blood. He basically bleeds out until at evening he died. And because he was bleeding out, the blood of the wound flowed down into the bottom of the chariot. And so it pools and starts to coagulate down by his feet, down by his body when his body collapses probably. And then about sunset, a cry went through the army, every man to his city, every man to his country. Now that's exactly what Micaiah prophesied, is that Israel would be like sheep without a shepherd scattered in the hills, and then everybody needed to go home. Mark your place. We'll continue the rest of this story the next time. God gives us a chance to be into his word.